Hello, David. I'm Jane Campbell, and I'm going to interview you today.
Happy to have you here. Yeah.
The current position in terms of the survival of the Kahau is well documented elsewhere, but you were there at the very beginning of the process. You were there on that first occasion with Robert Murphy and Louis Mowbray when you found the evidence of a surviving Kahau. I think you were 16 years old in 1951. Can you tell us why you were there?
The reason I was there is because at the time I was the only young person on Bermuda that had developed an obsessive interest in birds. Now, I was going to the sort of stiff upper lip, typical British school, Salters Grammar School in Pembroke, Bermuda. And the mere fact that I was interested in birds put me at a real disadvantage with not only my fellow students, but with the teachers, all of whom mocked me for this. So it was a very lonely period of life. And so birds really became an escape for me. Now, I came from a family of parents who were musical minded, and they hadn't any clue where this interest developed, but it was a spontaneous development which they could trace back to my early childhood, that I was fascinated by nature.
Yes.
And then it gradually evolved into a fascination with birds, and it was the Spittle Pond Wildlife Sanctuary that became the sort of defining moment of my interest, because I used to take walks with the dog around what was a very rural Bermuda at that time. And Spittle Pond fascinated me because the sea would flood into the pond like a river of water. And of course, I'd never been out of Bermuda to see what a real river or stream looked like. And whenever I went to Spittle Pond at that particular spot, there was always something new in the bird world, like my first swallows and then my first sandpipers on the great migration from the Arctic down to South America.
So how did you identify them?
There were various visitors to Bermuda at that time who were distinguished conservationists in North America, and I wish I could remember the name of one of them who became famous for starting the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary. My parents met him at various occasions and said, you know, my boy is interested in nature, but we don't know, you know, how to help him and what to do about it. And so it was Richard Poe who did the famous bird guides in America.
Right.
And he was a tremendous influence on my early career, because he was the first, I believe, to supply me with the Peterson Field Guide to the Birds.
Oh, okay.
And I was given it, I can never forget that, I was given it to me on a Christmas day as a Christmas present. And all my parents can remember is that I immediately disappeared for the rest of the day. And of course, I went to Spittle Pond to use this guide to identify a bird. So that was really why Louis Mowbray Jr., the son of the founder of the Bermuda Aquarium, it was Louis Septime Mowbray, was aware of my interest in birds. But he was also aware of it because before I got the Peterson Field Guide, I had no way of identifying these birds I was seeing. So I would draw pictures or paint pictures of them and take the picture to Louis Mowbray. And he would make an identification out of the obscure books in the back rooms and things and tell me. So when Dr. Murphy was inspired to come to Bermuda to search for the Kahau, Dr. Murphy being the world authority on oceanic birds at that time, it was Louis Mowbray who said, well, there's this young boy going to Salters who's developed quite an interest, and he might be useful to help scramble over the cliffs, you know, looking for looking for burrows for this.
Isn't that a wonderful thing?
Yeah. So that was how I came to be involved in that.
So David, in 1951, when you went out with these two celebrated men, were you aware of the Kahal?
I certainly was by that time. And other people in Bermuda who saw my potential as a naturalist had supplied me with natural history books about the previous century of birding in Bermuda, which was heavily influenced by officers of the garrisons of the British garrisons in Bermuda, many of whom were collectors of birds and wrote. And one of the most inspiring books was Rough Notes and Memoranda Relating to the Natural History of Bermudas by John L. Hurtis. And I read that book, which was literally a century before my time. And it was like a diary, and I had started keeping a diary myself at this point in time. And I took particular notes of the dates when different events happened. And I suddenly had this realization, my God, they were having exactly the same experiences back then as I am still having today. And the one that I will never forget reading, just caused the hairs to rise in the back of my neck, was a date in October when Hurtis got a call from somebody in Somerset Island that said they have found a bird dead which has a peculiar cross to the bill. And so Hurtis said, well, send it over by the ferry, which was the quickest way at that time, the alternate being horse and buggy to carry the message down to Hamilton. And so he went, met the ferry and got the bird and identified it as a yellow-billed cuckoo with a peculiar twist, you know, cross bill. So it wasn't a cross bill after all. And then I got a phone call from a lady in Somerset on the exact same date in October, 100 years later. And she says, I found this bird with a peculiar cross in the bill. Well, I had never seen a crossbill, and I thought, oh my God, this is probably a crossbill. Can you send it over to me on the ferry, which she did. And so I got the bird, and it was another yellow-billed cuckoo with a cross. And I thought I had remembered reading this in Hurtis's book. And so I searched out the book, and sure enough, exactly the same day, exactly the same.
That's really weird. That's
really,
spooky.
Really, you know, really amazing. Yes. So this is just one of the many things, you know, that inspired me into birding. But at any rate, through these same natural history books, I read about the early history of the Kahau and how it had been decimated. And the fact that as late, as recently as 1935, the year that I was born,
right.
A fledgling Kahau hit St. David's Lighthouse, which was a fixed light at that time and much more vulnerable to birds hitting it, and was proved to be a fledgling, so it had to have been reared on Bermuda. And that this was the year that I was born. And so at that point, I was that was only 16 years before. But of course, at that age, 16 years is like a lifetime, you know, because it is a lifetime for a young man. I always had this in mind that, God, if they survived that late on, you know, that's 300 years down the road from their supposed extinction. I wonder if they're still out there.
That's extraordinary, David, to think that the fledgling flew into St. David's Lighthouse in the year you were born. Do you feel that you were destined to have a relationship with the Kahau?
Well, not up until that point, but what I can remember very vividly is that one of the places that us young schoolboys used to explore in those days, one of the last few wildernesses in Bermuda, was the Walsingham Tract, which is riddled with limestone caves. And I often used to go in there with my friends, catching an awful dose of poison ivy in the process, but sometimes also on my own. And on one occasion, I went on my own specifically with the view of searching for cow bones, which were abundant in the fossil deposits at the bottom of these caves. And on this particular day, I stumbled on a whole bunch of cow bones as I went down. And I knew this from the published literature, that that's what these bones were. And I remember coming out into the sunlight with these bones and looking at them in the sunlight and thinking, gosh, I wonder what these bones were like when they had flesh and blood on them. And at that point, I looked up and there was a lovely view across Castle Harbour of the Castle Harbour Islands. And the sun was glittering and I just thought, God, I wonder if they're still out there.
Yes, what an amazing experience to have. It's very moving.
So it wasn't long after that when I got that magic phone call from Louis Mowbray.
Yes.
And I knew that the Murphy-Mowbray expedition was in Bermuda. It was January 1951. And I knew they were in Bermuda, and Mowbray had promised to let me know, you know, when they were going out to the Castle Harbour Islands. But fortuitously, Bermuda being a terribly windy place in the winter is always subject to gales. And fortuitously, the whole of the school week, when I would absolutely not have been allowed to go on the expedition, even as important as this expedition was, because you just, you know, you were a schoolboy and you just had to be in school.
You were only 16.
So that whole week, they were prevented from getting out onto the most hopeful site for finding cows, which was the offshore islands, by these gales. And so they did other things, which didn't turn up much more than a few more fossil bones. But then the call came through on a Saturday morning, luckily just before I left for Spittle Pond. If I had gone to Spittle Pond a little earlier, I wouldn't have gotten the call. My parents couldn't have contacted me. And Mowbray said, can you be at the aquarium within an hour? And boy, was I down there on my pedal bike, because it was only a mile away. And that was when I joined the famous expedition on the day of rediscovery, January 28th, 1951. I can still remember that date.
So that is the day when the three of you set off.
And a beautiful sunny day it was, quite breezy. Now, I said before that I came from a musical family that were immigrants, recent immigrants to Bermuda. So unlike all the other Bermuda-born, you know, of Bermudian parents who were all boaters and sailors and so forth, I had no experience with boat whatsoever. The nearest thing that I had come to a boat was a kayak, which some friends of mine built with the help of their father. And I remember the year before, 1950, knowing about the cows again and knowing that the last, in fact, it was this kayak expedition was inspired by that experience I had in the cave at Walsingham and seeing the Castle Harbour Islands in the sunlight.
Yes.
So we paddled our kayak all the way down to these islands, and I'd never been out on the rough ocean before, and these islands were out where the ocean swell comes in.
I remember.
And all we had was a little canvas, you know, covered kayak. And I looked at these spiky islands, which I thought, if the cow's going to survive, it's going to be on these islands. And we circled them with our kayak, and we thought, there's no way we're going to puncture the hull. And that was a remote area in those days, and no one would have necessarily found us, you know, for a day or two. So we had to abort my personal attempt to rediscover the cow. And ironically, they were nesting on the very islands that we tried to land on that day, but we couldn't do it because we didn't have the right equipment. And I was afraid of the ocean swell and everything. So when we landed on the first of these little islands that I'd circled the year before, I was a complete boat klutz. You know, I didn't know nothing about handling a boat. And I remember Libby Mowbray asked me to throw a line or something, and I had my hand over the bow, and the boat was just about to, you know, smash into the island, and it would have crushed my hand. This is a classic mistake that non-boaters make. And I remember Lou Mowbray screaming at me, "Get your hand out there!" You know, so I felt, you know, really nervous and insecure. And these islands are very hard to land on, and so that is my vivid memory of that particular island.
David, can you say something about the boat you did go in that day, and also the little island or islet that you're landing on?
Well, the boat was the aquarium official work boat called the Iridio, long since departed this world. And so it was a heavy wooden boat with a diesel engine. And, you know, I'd almost never been on a boat like that up to that point in my life. And so landing on these tiny little islands, which are all of them less than half an acre, in fact, less than a quarter of an acre, and so rocky and spiky and devoid of vegetation that the rock is eroded, the middle limestone erodes along the seashore into these spiky, jagged structures that are very difficult to walk on, let alone jump out of a boat and land on, you know, with a rise and fall of the sea of about 4 feet, which it was on that particular occasion. So not being a boater, I went through a pretty frightening experience just to get on those islands. But of course, once I was on them, I was on home territory again, and then I was able to be useful searching. But it was another island around the corner where it was a little easier to land, where we actually found evidence of cahows.
As a schoolboy, I guess you were more agile than your two adult companions, so you were more easily able to explore the island.
Yeah. Once safely back on land, I was in my own element again, because I had spent years exploring for longtail nests on Bermuda's rugged cliffs. And so I was more useful in terms of getting up to difficult places where these more elderly gentlemen weren't able to get. And so I found a couple of what looked like very deep crevices that you couldn't see the end of, and called Louis Mowbray, who had the flashlight and everything, and he began, we realized we couldn't see the end, so we had to pull out a lot of sand that was mounded up between the entrance and the back of this long tunnel. It was about 15 feet long. And so it took a while to do that, but Murphy had already said there's something in there, because look, here's the green and white excrement that is, I'm familiar with, seabirds, particularly oceanic seabird excrement, and I can smell the smell of petrels here. So there's something in there, and look, there are footprints, you can see footprints. So it took us a good part of the day just to be able to remove the sandbank so we could see the bird at the end. And then Mowbray realized that you couldn't identify it from that distance, and this with the light of a flashlight. So Mowbray said, "Well, I have a long pole back in the boat. I can make a noose, and we'll try and noose the bird." Well, that took about an hour longer, and the tension building all the time. And then finally, the bird was successfully noosed, and Mowbray pulled it out, and Murphy picked up the bird, held it up like this, spread the wings, and said, "By gad, the cahow." Of course, he was a New Englander, you know, the old-fashioned New Englander, so "by gad" is a classic term. And that moment I'll never forget. So that was really the moment that determined my career, because I was not an indoor office type person. I couldn't, it would have driven me crazy. I had to be outdoors in nature. And I thought, well, what better career can I make for myself now than to be the guy to help bring the cahow back from the verge of extinction?
So, David, what happened next?
Well, at the age of 16, you're graduating from high school, and then comes the next big scary step. Do you go on into higher education, or do you get a boring job somewhere and spend the rest of your life, you know, sitting in an office? I was encouraged by people like Richard Poe and Dr. Murphy himself to go on to get an education, because I was clearly a naturalist, and they recommended that the best university to apply to was Cornell. So I applied to Cornell, not having much hope of getting there, because due to the circumstances of my school experience, you know, being so henpecked by the other boys for being a dicky birder, and hating sports, hating organized sports like cricket, boring cricket, and football, which always happened. I had to attend football games when the days were getting short in October, when the migratory bird was peaking. And so I would miss my opportunity after school to go out and see what new birds had come in, because I had to sit on the football field. Anyway, I think the only reason I got accepted at Cornell is because they placed a big emphasis on getting foreign students at that time to sort of mix, you know, very good intercultural mixing. And because Dr. Murphy wrote a recommendation for me.
Right.
And so once I got to Cornell, I discovered for the first time in my life that there are other young men of my age, and young women as well, who had the same interests as I and didn't mock me for my interest. And so I fell in with an exciting group of young naturalists, and I was exposed, you know, to American mammals and bats and things for the first time, all of the American birds that hadn't yet been recorded in Bermuda. I remember one of my friends was a mammalogist who was studying bats, and some of our little side expeditions during the spring break, when I could never afford to come back to Bermuda, we would go off, and I remember once going down to a cave in Virginia, and I had quite a bit of experience with caves in Bermuda. So I was able to be useful on this. And we got into this one cave that was notoriously difficult to get into the back of. You had to cross vertical chasms that you could only cross by straddling them with your legs and things like that, you know. And if you slipped, fell, that was the end of you, and you knew that. And then crawl through little tiny holes, you know, that only bats could get through, to get into these huge chasms where they were roosting all on the roof. So I had all these wonderful experiences. In my second to last and last years at Cornell, the professor of ornithology at that time, who was Charles Sibley, invited me to go on undergraduate bird collecting expeditions, the first one to Mexico in 1953, and the next one to the Great Plains. We went out to the Great Plains in 1956, collecting hybrid birds along the Platte River. And that was a wonderful experience, because this was buffalo country, you know, and that history of the extermination of the buffalo was so recent, you could still see, you couldn't see their footprints, but you could still see the cuts in the riverbed where they, you know, where they had trampled down to cross rivers and things like that.
What I hear in that story, David, is your hunger to understand and to get close to the natural world was finally being fed. So can I take you back to the Cajao? What happened after you graduated from Cornell?
Yeah. That's a good line to get back into. Yeah. Okay. I graduated in 1957. Now armed with all of these wonderful new experiences and qualifications, techniques, you know, bird banding, bird collecting with shotgun and so forth, and I could have gone on to graduate school. That would have been the next logical step. But at the back of my mind, all the 4 years I had been at Cornell, I knew that the Kahau desperately needed help, and I was stuck in university, becoming qualified, and that period in Bermuda was filled in by a group of three different graduate students who were a little older than me, who were hired by Dr. Murphy and Mowbray to come down to Bermuda during their Christmas break now to work on the Kahau and hopefully begin to learn more. Well, there were two aspects of this. One, in those days, university expeditions had to be squeezed into vacation time. These days, you can legitimately go off as part of your university experience. So they were only coming to Bermuda in that narrow period between late December and early January. And what we didn't know at the time is that this is the pre-laying exodus period of the Kahau, when the entire population goes to sea for 40 days. And so the net result of their findings was that the shock of rediscovery has scared the last Kahaus away. I mean, that's a very succinct way of summarizing it, but that was the impression that they got. Now, I met these people when my parents did manage to allow me to come back home for Christmas only. So I had the privilege of overlapping with these three graduate students who were doing this research, and I helped them by going on night watches and things with them. But that was the only contact I had with the Kahau during that period. And my vivid recollection of that was what they were experiencing, that this was we didn't know there was such a thing as a pre-laying exodus, but there were just no Kahaus to see out there. We would sit out in these lonely islands at night and nothing would ever happen.
So it looked as though the Kahau that you had found had disappeared, and the Kahau was now truly extinct.
Well, for me, what this underscored is that the situation was really, really critical, and I could not afford to go on to graduate school. I had to come back to Bermuda, so I made that difficult choice against a lot of stronger advice, I might add. But I made it because we knew so little, and I had this sense that the Kahaus, if they lasted 300 years, they weren't going to be scared away by the shock of rediscovery. So something else was going on here, and someone needed to be, someone who was Bermudian, who was living in Bermuda full-time, needed to be there to monitor the whole year round to try and figure out what was really happening.
Because at that time, there was very little known about oceanic birds.
Almost nothing, really. They were birds of complete mystery, landing on remote islands that were hard of access, living underground in burrows, most of them nocturnal. And that was the reason, incidentally, that the Kahau evaded detection for 300 years, because it lives on the ocean where no one can find it, especially as rare as it had become. And from what we know about its range now, they were still ranging over the entire North Atlantic. Even though there were only 18 pairs, they still covered their original range. Imagine trying to find them, in all of that ocean. So, sorry, I've lost my track. Now we'll have to stop there.
Okay, right. It's a big decision to forfeit a postgraduate career to follow up on the Kahau. How were you able to afford that? How were you able to make the decision?
Well, of course, I couldn't have afforded it. My parents were extremely generous in saying, we had a big rambling house, and my other three sisters and brothers had graduated and moved around the world. So there was plenty of space to house me. And I thought I would be good to bum off them for a few more years, while I got on my feeding. But the real reason I was able to do it is because, thanks to Dr. Murphy, through the New York Zoological Society, the aquarium was able to secure a grant to do research on the Kahau. That was the same grant that these other three graduate students had, you know, come down to Bermuda on. And so I was employed under that grant, and it wasn't a lot, but it was enough to say that I had a legitimate job. Yeah.
So you had the grant and you were able to start your research on the Kahau. And what happened after that?
Well, the first thing I really needed to do was to become a skilled boater, because I can tell you that the Castle Harbour Islands are the most remote and dangerous waters in all of Bermuda. And I knew not only that, but that I was going to have to be visiting these islands and staying on them overnight. So landing and getting off them, either I had to stay overnight on these uncomfortable islands, or I had to be prepared, skilled enough to be able to land and get off them in the middle of the night. I purchased a small 12-foot molded plywood hull boat with a 10-horsepower Johnson engine, I believe it was at the time. It might have been an Evinrude engine, but I had the whole summer because we graduate in June, you know, and so I had the whole of July and August to learn how to use this boat and become skilled at using it. And then the excitement of not knowing when the Kahaus really, you know, turn up in the fall, so that the excitement of looking forward to checking those islands starting in October when we thought they might return, and then just, you know, finding the first proof of the birds. At that time, we only had 7 nests that we knew about that were under observation. And I learned that the way to monitor them, if you couldn't stay overnight on the island, and too often the weather was too bad to even think about that, you would smooth the sand in front of the burrows, if they had sand in front of them, and then stick little twigs at the entrances, and if the twigs were not down and the footprints were still there and hadn't been erased by the wind or the rain, then you knew that a bird had come or gone from the nest. And because a lot of these nests also we couldn't see into, you see, they were so deep. And this is one of the reasons the Kahau escaped detection for all these centuries, because they nested only in burrows that were so deep and twisting that the light couldn't reach the end. That was an essential requirement for their nesting. And they came and went only at night. So to actually see them at all in flight, you had to be on the islands at night. And so as early as that first fall, 1957 through 58, I started risking mooring my boat and staying on these islands overnight.
So David, what year have we reached by now?
Well, 1957, the year that I graduated from Cornell and returned to Bermuda full-time, you have to realize this was already the Kahau was rediscovered in 1951, so it was already 6 years later, and we still knew almost nothing about, you know, what was going on, why was the Kahau so rare, and what could we do to help it out.